This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, coming to you once again from our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and want to welcome everybody tuning in throughout North America, Sirius 219, XM Channel 206, and of course, all of you tuning in worldwide at horseracingradio.net. Listeners in 167 countries made us their home for racing coverage in 2016, and happy to have you with us again here in 2017. JT, how are you, my friend?
I'm all right. It's another lovely day, and looking forward to our guest. I love when we have the new guys on.
The up-and-comers in the sport.
Yeah, I love it.
That's one of the cool... This has been, for years now, one of our favorite shows, right? Trainer Talk. It started, believe it or not, with Ron Ellis a couple of years ago when we sat down with Ron for the full hour at Santa Anita, and it's just kind of grown. We've talked with Todd Pletcher. We've talked with Mark Cassie, Bill Mott, Graham Motion. You name it. All of the big-name trainers have been here, and we continue that tradition tonight with a guest who might not be a household name yet. And I say yet because he's gotten off to a quick start in just a few months of training on his own. His name is John Ortiz. Goes by John Alexander Ortiz, if we're going to get formal with it. He's a native of Colombia. He came to the United States with his family when he was just 5 years old. And after working for many, many, many prominent trainers, he started training on his own in November of last year at the age of 30. And how about this, Jude? You talk about getting off to a quick start. You know a thing or two about this when you were training. Saddled 11 starters last year, two winners from those 11 starters. Pretty good.
Yeah, that's very good considering some guys go like 0 for 84 before they have their first one. So it's great to get off on the right foot. And of course, with the experience that John has and the trainers that he's worked for, it's not surprising.
John spending the winters at Oaklawn in Arkansas, and he's with us now here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I read somewhere that when you were 21 years old, you said that all you wanted to do was be a trainer by the time you were 30. Well, mission accomplished.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. You know, actually, my whole life goal dream was to become a jockey because my dad was a jockey. So when I was 21, I realized the weight was not going to cut it, and I like hamburgers way too much. And I was like, you know what, I think I'm just rather stick and be a trainer. I was like, I'll do it when I'm 30.
Yeah, well, you know, you have those goals and aspirations now. I don't know if you know what I look like, but there's no way I ever considered being a jockey. I was 5 pounds over when I was in kindergarten, so, you know, there was none of that for me. But I was pretty much the same way, wanting to train, and it was it was just such a dream come true when it finally happened.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I agree with you there. I mean, I wasn't expecting it. I owned two fillies of my own, and I entered one under Kellen's name, and Barbara, the steward in Kentucky, she told me, like, Johnny, why don't you run these horses under your name? And I was like, I don't know. She said, why don't you go get your license? So I did, and with encouraging, and then I was like, I'll just run my horses. And that's how I got my license, just to run my own horse, just to do it. And then I realized, I was like, hey, I turned 30. I did it. I'm a trainer.
Well, John, was it always horse racing for you, or was there a time when you thought about doing something outside of the sport?
Well, my family, through my dad, it's a horse family. My dad was a jockey, law, you know, back in Colombia, and he came to the States in the late 80s, which he did quite well in Mid-Atlantic circuit there. And so, yeah, I've always wanted to just be a jockey, like I said, but when I was in high school, I kind of got into cars. Back then, it was just all about the Honda Civics that everybody was working on, and we had the Fast and the Furious movies coming out, so kind of got my attention. So I actually went to a school and became an automotive technician in auto body. So I actually got a certificate or a degree in that, if you want to get serious there. So I did try to get involved with the cars, but that just never got off the ground.
When did you start working on the racetrack?
I've been involved in the track since I was maybe 12 years old. Just walking around, following my dad to the barns in the morning and walking into Bill Mott's. My dad was galloping for Bill at the time, and he'd just wake up. I'd wake up before my dad just so, I could jump in the car with him and go in the mornings on the weekends. And watch him gallop, watch the horses, walk a few here, walk the pony, ride the pony. And that's how I started getting involved when I was around 12, 13. And then one summer, I remember we were sitting at a barbecue with Billy. My dad throws these big parties, like around August for my mom's birthday. And Bill Ma, I remember Pletcher was being there. Yeah, I think Pletcher came out one time. A bunch of agents, I mean... It was just a big gathering of horse people in our backyard, and my dad would have a cookout, and everybody's sitting on this big table. You know how it is with horsemen. It's just exchanging horse stories after horse story, and I did this, and I did that, and I remember Bill Mott, I would sit there, and Bill Mott just looked at me across the table and said, "Johnny, what are you doing this summer?" I said, "Nothing. I'm just playing video games or something." He's like, "Why don't you just come and work for me all summer?" And that's when I actually started working and got involved and saw more of a routine of being in the barn, and I just fell in love with it. Just wanted to be at the track every day after that.
What's the best Bill Mott story you remember when you were sitting around with your dad and Bill at those events?
I'll tell you, this is my favorite story. I actually have a picture of it, too, and I actually carry it around, and it's in my phone, and I actually have the actual photo in my car. But I think I was about 14 years old, and I was just raking the ground, raking the shed, and I think Bill had one last set, and he was just standing in, he was riding his pony, and Bill just looked at me, and then there's a horse that's tacked up, ready to go. Her name was Brown Eyed Lass. And beautiful filly, I think she was a three-year-old at the time. But anyway, so he looked at me, he looked at the filly, he looked at me, and he said, "Put on a helmet, Johnny, and put on your vest." So I put on a helmet and a vest. He legged me up on this horse, and he ponied me around the track, on the training track. And it was just, I was like, holy smokes, like I'm on a race horse with Bill Mott. Bill Mott, to me, I always looked at him like an uncle or like a dad or something. So it was just like, but I'm on the racetrack on a racehorse with Billy Mott. And that was just, I think from then on, I was like, I want to learn how to ride now. And that's when that bug started.
That's fantastic. Well, you had steward Barbara Borden tell you to get a trainer's license. You got Billy Mott asking you to go to work for him. Then you got him putting you on a horse. I mean, what a blessed life you've had.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, that's what I think of it. I mean, right now I look at my life and I definitely would say I'm blessed. I'm very grateful for every single path that I've taken to get here. That's for sure. No regrets on anything.
Well, last year you did take out your trainer's license. I mentioned that occurred in November of last year. Then in December you saddle your first winner. That came at Turfway Park. But you bring up your wife, Crystal. And you and Crystal married last year and then recently welcomed a son. So congratulations there, John.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is your son going to be a horse trainer?
Oh, who knows? he's not going to be a jockey because I think he was born 8 ounces and 4 pounds. And he was just big. He's massive. And right now, I think a month later, he was like 10 pounds. And he's just not going to be a jockey. So if he wants to follow the racetrack, I'd rather him go, like my dad instilled in me, you better go to school, get all your degrees, and then figure out what you want to do from there,
Well, that's a good way to go, an excellent path. I always tell the young trainers that come on this show, Laz Barrera told me one time, whenever you have a kid, you go on a hot streak. So It happened to Thomas Morley. He won his first grade one. We're looking for big things from you now that you have a kid.
It happened with you too, didn't it, John?
Yeah, it sure did. I mean, like, I heard the same thing. And, like I said, my son was born, like, 2 days after I officially went off on my own when Kevin Gorda went. You know, he went away on a suspension. And then I officially was, okay, it's my barn. I got my own name, my own tech. And so that was, I thought that was a, you know, good thing happening right there. And then shortly, you know, like I said, we started winning, and I was like, wow, this is, we got the baby luck. That's what we call it. We got the baby luck still going. So.
And I read somewhere that you said that once your son came into this world, it completely changed your entire perspective on training and on this profession. Is that true?
It sure is. You know, like I do it for him. I do it for him and my wife. I do it for my family. My wife has a son prior to us getting married, and I love him. His name is Xavier, and Xavier and Crystal and Jaden is my reason to get up in the mornings. You know, they're currently staying in Lexington, and obviously I'm here in Hot Springs right now, but it's just not, it hasn't been one morning that I wake up and it's, first thing, it's my son I think about. And then when I get into the barn, it's just like, well, if, you know, this has to work for them. It really is. And, you know, when I was starting out, you know, when I had these plans and you're galloping and you're hanging out with your friends and, you know, you'll go to bars and you go to dinners and you hang out, you know, and you see, oh, well, these trainers got these cars and they got these fancy houses and they got these really nice barns and they're dressing so good. It's like, man, I can't wait to train until I'm actually being successful in it and have all this stuff. And then my son is born and I realize I'm already successful. You know, this is what success is to me right now. I have my barn and I have my family. And I think this is why I want to do it. Not to buy that Mercedes Benz, you know, which hopefully I'll buy it some other time down the road. But right now, this is what I live for. And this is all for them.
Talking with trainer John Ortiz here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, you bring up the point, and this is a point that several other trainers have brought up on this program over the years. Your wife and your newborn child are living in Lexington. You are at Oaklawn for the winter doing your thing, making a living. How difficult is that to be separated, and how do you cope with it?
FaceTime, it works so well, I'll tell you that. It's a typical racetracker life, I want to say. You know, my dad did it, and I think his was probably worse, when he left my mom in Colombia with me. I probably was maybe 2 years old, and I didn't get to see him again probably until I was four. And my dad came to the States to start riding and getting his career and getting his paperwork all set up right. And so it was, I mean, he came down to visit, you know, a few times, but it's, you know, he didn't have FaceTime. But yeah, I FaceTime my wife, you know, after I'm done training, you know, before we go to bed, if we on the drive home, you know, you could put it on the side of the car and you could hear each other on the speakers. So, you know, it's okay. You know, I wish I could actually hold them, but it kind of gets away from, you know, having that. I actually, you know, when, you know, out of sight, out of mind, and it kind of makes it like really hard to. It's better when you can see them, you know, and so FaceTime helps out a lot, and I'm pretty sure that's what a lot of people do. But, you know, we prepared ourselves when we found out that that Crystal was pregnant. You know, my routine's always been come to Oakland for Kellen Gorder. And so we kind of just sat down and was like, well, how's it going to work? You know, we'll leave right after the baby's born, and is she going to be okay, or does she need help? My mom came up, and she came up to Lexington from Florida, and she helped us for about 20 days, you know, while the baby was still a newborn, and, you know, going through making sure we had cooked and this and that. So now that my son, he's at daycare, and Crystal's back to work. So we already kind of had a plan on how we were going to cope with it, and we knew it was going to happen. We didn't expect it to happen with my own outfit this year. So a lot of FaceTime and phone calls, and I plan on driving up every 3 weeks to visit them, you know, for about 3 or 4 days at a time.
Does your wife ever set your son in front of the TV when you have a horse running and say, okay, this is daddy's horse. This is who we have to cheer for. Is he old enough to comprehend any of that yet?
No, he's not. He's, I think he's just turning, he'll be turning two months on Sunday. So, yeah, he doesn't understand. But he's smiling a lot now, though. And when he puts, when we're on FaceTime, she puts the face real close and he hears my voice and you can see him start to smile. I like to think that he kind of recognizes my voice now. And so that's a good thing. But he doesn't understand horses yet. But Xavier does. And he knows he cheers on for jockeys and he cheers on for my, is that our horse, Johnny? He's like, yeah, that's our horse. Okay, we're going to win.
How old is Xavier?
Xavier is 4 years old. He just turned four in August.
Yeah, so he's already going to the whip when he's watching the replays.
he is. You know, it's funny because he'll watch a horse cross the wire, and he's like, oh, man. Even if we win, he'll go, oh, man, we lose. I'm like, no, we actually won. He's like, no, but we always lose. I'm like, oh, gosh. Yeah, you lose more than you win, you know. So he's been around a lot of those seconds and thirds, and he's like, oh, we won this time. Okay.
Well, John, let's go back to a name you mentioned earlier, and that's Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott. That is exactly where your career started. And then you went to work for Grand Motion, Barkley Tag, and then eventually Kellen Gorder before going out on your own last year. Start with Bill Mott. Take me through those years that you were working with Bill. What was that like?
Fantastic. Like I told you, it was family. I felt like it's family. Just learning everything I know about horses, I will credit Bill Mott to ever putting in my head. I sat on the rail one day. I told him, Bill, because I remember Bill used to gallop horses, and I never got to see him gallop horses, but I told him, Bill, what's the difference between galloping and standing on the rail and watching a horse? And he says, son, you know, sometimes you see differently when you're not on a horse, and sometimes you can feel when you're on the horse. And explained it to me, and that will always stick in my head because I ride most of my horses, and so I'm always thinking the same thing. Just simple horsemanship skills I got from Bill Mott, just from watching him. He's so I don't know, what's the word, I want to say even magical, you know, just the way he just handles, he can control a horse with a long rein, a long shank, and just feel the horse. And it's always been mind-blowing, and I always try to treat my horses the same way he treated them. And then, you know, growing up in his barn, it was, like I said, it's just like growing up in my house. You know, I'll tell you what, I was disciplined in that barn just as good as I could have been in my own home. And by that, you know, I had, the assistants there. They were tough on me. I understand why. They taught me a lot, you know, down from Leanna and Kenny, who's assistant at Churchill and Gulfstream. And those guys, you know, I probably gave, and I understand how horrible I probably was to them at the time, you know, just being such a young kid and just trying to know it all or whatever. But they explained to me how to be professional at the workplace, how you want to do this. And same thing, just horseman skills. They passed all that stuff on to me. And to this day, I'm very thankful for Bill Mott and Leanna and Kenny for always teaching me the basics of what I needed to know as far as workmanship skills and horsemanship skills. And that's what I got out of working for Bill Mott. You know, and I started there as a hot walker, and then I started grooming horses in my summer breaks. And then eventually, when I finished at automotive school, started working for them as a gallop boy, and I already kind of knew how to ride a little bit there, and then did just sharpen my skills up. And then I started traveling with some of his stakes horses out of town, you know, just a traveling groom, a traveling foreman, and kind of had that in my back of my on my head that I wanted to be an assistant for Billy Mott one day. And I didn't have my assistant's license while I was working with Bill, but you know, like I said, every time they shipped the stake horses out of town, you know, I'd be the one that would be in charge until Bill would get in, you know, taking care of the horse, riding the horse, and just handling all the before stake races kind of deal that we, you know, make sure the owners are licensed, we got the silks in, the papers are in, pre-racing, all that stuff. So he did, I believe that, you know, he believed in me enough to trust in me that much with his horses. So, and then shortly after there, I started working for Grand Motion. I think it was in 2008, 2009, I believe. And same thing, I just worked in that barn. I was a little bit more cautious about my professional work. And when I worked with Grand Motion, same thing, just to like a foreman, barn foreman, and I galloped all his horses every set, breezed a lot of horses. I got to breeze Better Talk Now. I think that was pretty cool. And what else? And I just loved watching him. The way Graham just enters a barn, it's not like, oh, the boss is here, or it's just, oh, you know, it was his presence was very joyful. And his, you know, Grand Motion, he is just a great character, a great gentleman. He's just, and I love that about him. And it just, he's always kept his cool. He handled the barn very professional. And I love that. It was a business. It was, besides him being a great horseman, you know, he handled it a very strict business kind of end of it, you know, and I really enjoyed watching him, how he handled that part. And, you know, I think I was there for about a year and a half with him. And then somebody offered me an assistant job, like a full-time assistant job, and that fell through, but I already had told Graham that I was going to leave. And when I left, that fell through. So I ended up just walking around trying to figure out what I was going to do. Try to be a jockey or produced. I couldn't do it. I just gave up on that. But then I started working with a couple of trainers here, helping them here and there. I worked with Greg DePrima for, I think, a summer, and that's in New York. And I think after that, I ended up working for Barkley Tag. And although I worked for Barkley Tag for about 3 months, it brought me to Keeneland. And I came to Keeneland with about 3 horses for him. And I ended up, I think we won 3 races in 2 seconds with 5 horses. We won the Root and Rail Dowager Stakes that year. I can't remember the filly's name, but that's the year I actually met Kellen Gorder. And then Kellen offered me a job. And then that's how I ended up working for Kellen in Lexington. I loved Keeneland. I loved Kentucky. I fell in love with the area. And when I was, I think in November 2011, it's when I started working for Kellen Gorder as his assistant. And this was my first time as, you know, here's Kellen, the trainer, and then it's John Ortiz now, the assistant, the first assistant. And I took that role on pretty seriously, and I love working for Kellen. One of the best jobs I've had, because working for Kellen, he's so laid back. He's such a good friend that he trusts in you so much that he gives you so much slack to do what is right by you. You know, we'll make mistakes. I'll make mistakes. We correct each other. Hey, fix this. Don't do this. Don't do this. Do it like this. But it's just like more of a free range thing, which is, I think it's what helped me become a better horseman, as far as I can trust myself to doing this in my own barn, because like I've done it with, you know, and that was just really great. I think having that experience with Kellen. I think I ran 3 barns for him last summer. You know, we had 2 good foremen in each outfit, and I would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then I would probably leave the house around 4, check legs at Keeneland in Lexington, watch the first set breeze, or the first and second set breeze, and then drive an hour down to Louisville, watch the next couple of sets there, watch those horses breeze, and then drive all the way back to the training center at Paris and watch the last few sets there and watch those horses train and breeze. So I had a handful last in 2015. That was a good driving year for me, but I loved it. You know, I understood what it takes to be around these horses and be responsible for these horses and just be there. It was just such an important lesson that I learned from Kellen Gorder.
Well, Kellen is a natural horseman. We worked together at 505 Farm. He was the farm trainer there, and I was running the farm at the time. And I was always impressed with his horsemanship. And as you say, he's a very laid-back guy. He's very quiet. And he thinks a lot, but he doesn't often say a lot. But he's so successful. He actually trained a grade one winner off of the training track at 505 Farm, which is amazing. And I just have tremendous respect for his horsemanship and his abilities.
I'll tell you what, and the same thing with Bill Mott, Kellen Gorder. I think they came up from the same teacher, Jack Vanberg. And I see it, now that I work around Jack, I've seen him train closely, and it's just like amazing. The horsemanship skills that Kellen has just blew my mind. I think it was the first year that I met him because he had a farm and he was breaking yearlings. And I've never been around anything younger than a two-year-old that's already breeding 3/8. That to me was a baby. But when I actually got to see what a yearling looked like, what a breaking yearling, and just the way he handles these young horses was just, it was mind blowing. I loved it. And then I was like, man, I want to get a farm. I want to do it like Kellen. It was just amazing. Even on a horse, Kellen, he started getting back on his own horses here, recently this year. And it's just so great to just watch him gallop. And he's like, I got my style and he has his style, but he knows how to read a horse's mind just through his hands and just through touch. And that's always been very inspirational, just watching Kellen in the barn, period. It's just so good.
John Ortiz with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. So many other stories to get to in the second half of the program. Make sure you stay with us. We'll do that for you when we come back. Don't forget, if you miss any portion, head to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of this program and all of our shows. They're there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. We're back. The second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, is next. The heat is on. Fasig Tipton is now accepting nominations to the Gulfstream Selected 2-Year-Old in Training Sale. The Gulfstream Sale takes place March 1st, 2017 at Gulfstream Park with an under-tax show on February 27th. Having outperformed the market last year with massive gains over 2015, including an increased median of 92%, an increased average of 45%, and a top price of $1.8 million, the Gulfstream sale was the only sale that displayed a fully upward trajectory among the 7 juvenile sales hosted by North American auction companies. 6 buyers spent more than $1 million. 20 buyers spent $500,000 or more, and the top 11 hips in last year's sale were purchased by 10 unique entities and consigned by 9 unique entities. Nominate now. It's the Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 1st, 2017 at Gulfstream Park.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Meyer, one of the names of the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
and they're on their way home. It's Easy Suava cuts the corner, but here's Red Charm up to the outside. These two are three lengths in front of Promise Me Snow, who did not kick on. 1/8 of a mile left. Easy Suava off those slow fractions coming back, but Red Charm bearing down to the outside. Now Red Charm has the upper hand. Red Charm opening them up in final 16th as they race down to the wire. Here's lifetime victory number one for Johnny Ortiz. Red Charm wins it by about two. Easy Suava was second. Photo for third, 142 flat.
A very special night for our friend John Ortiz joining us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. That was December 7th of last year, race 5 at Turfway Park. Red Charm, ridden by Julie Burke, provided young John Ortiz with his first win as a trainer, and at the age of 30, he can say that he achieved goal number one in his life and his career, and now he is off to a flying start, won 2 of 11 races last year, and spending the winter at Oaklawn, looking to add to that total here in 2017.
Yeah, Oaklawn Park, not an easy place to race. A lot of tough competition there.
He's Jude Feld. I'm Mike Penna. You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, and John, Jude brings up a good point. Oaklawn can be pretty tough in the winter. Why was Oaklawn the right choice for you?
Oaklawn, I want to call it my second home. I know this track very, very well. I love it here. And, you know, the reason to come in here is obviously my owners are, this is their home track. You know, I have, I train for Thomas Julian, and he's a, the one that got me started. He, we started claiming horses for him at Churchill here in November throughout the whole meet. And the horses that I claimed were specifically claimed to target this track. Horses that are obviously can, you know, can be a little just as tough at Churchill. But these higher claimer horses, they could do very well at Oakland because it's not, I don't want to say this track is not a biased track. You know, this track is, the 50-1 shot has just as much shot as winning as the heavy favorite. And just knowing that I know this track very well, and this has gives me so much more confidence that I can compete with Steve Asmussen, that I can compete with Kenny McPeak, and so on and so on. You know, I'm not afraid of being here just because there's heavy names or, you know, more money. You know, some people get intimidated that the money here is probably going to draw more stronger horses. But at the same time, you know, they're all horses. They all can go just as fast as the other one. And it's just a matter of getting lucky, having this fittest horse, and that's it. You know, so I'm very comfortable here. This is second home for me.
John, why is knowing the track such an advantage for a trainer?
Oh, I love this question. You know, because, you know, I ride all my horses. You know, I got, well, most of them. I can only get on so many. I have 13 right now, and being on them gets me across the whole surface, not just, you know, from the trainer stand. I'm not looking at the same surface, that same three-quarter pole track piece of dirt right there. You know, I'm actually around the whole track, so I know when, let's say there's a rainy day, I know when not to be in down by the rail in the middle of the track. The outside's better, you know, or maybe there's a conveyor belt that, you know, you hear a lot of jockeys talking about this, that, you know, you're on a certain part of the track and it's like a conveyor belt. You just hit this specific spot and your horse is hitting the ground right and just picks up and goes. So knowing, you know, especially in the mornings, I'll be out there breezing. I breeze my horses. And then when I, you know, I'm struggling down on the rail and I find, you know, the third path, what's the best path for my horse, I could relay that on in the afternoon when I see my jocks, be like, hey, listen, today the track was like this, try to be on this part, you know. But, and jocks know too, but I just, it's very important to know your track because it also helps you maintain a sounder horse.
Yeah.
And get the best performance out of them, you know.
Yeah, knowing the pitfalls of a racing surface can really make a difference sometimes. Although one time it worked against me, I gave the jock instructions. I was at Louisiana Downs and the horse was running on the turf, and I said, "Well, you know, the inside of the turf has been terrible all week long. Nobody's been able to make up any ground. I said, stay about three paths off the rail. That filly led the entire race, 1 3/8 until the last jump, and Gary Stevens came up the inside and nailed us on the wire. And my jock was so upset when he came back. I think he wanted to yell at me. and I said, not your fault. You rode perfectly. You did exactly what I wanted to do. It was a tough beat for both of us. It was a graded stakes, and it was a very, very difficult race. I think there were 7 Hall of Fame trainers saddled horses in that race, and I was not one of them.
See, that's so interesting to me. It never occurred to me that knowing the track so well, knowing every intricacy, could be such an advantage day in and day out for a trainer, especially a trainer like John that's stabled at a track like Oaklawn for the entire winter. John, just curious, what's the most bizarre set of instructions that you've ever given to a jockey or you've ever heard a trainer give to a jockey?
Oh, my favorite. Okay, I'm going to tell this is my favorite. Kellen Gordon is going to have a ball with this one. But we had an owner he's like, believed in this lady that used to telepathically communicate with horses. And she was in Maryland and we're in Kentucky, and he told us, he's like, I'm going to have this lady talk to this horse. And we're like, okay, hey, no problem. The report back was that after the lady had talked to her filly, she said that she's just out there just plodding around. She has a little tune in her head and she's just enjoying the race. She sees horses go by, and I'm like, okay, whatever. And that her instructions are, it's like, maybe if she had a faster tune in her head, she might run faster. And we're like, okay. So Kellen and I were just like, okay, that's interesting. It's, you know, you never put anything, you know, below you. It's like, you take everything. You learn so much from people just out of, you know, just what do you believe in? This? Okay, well, we'll try that. So I remember the filly was entered to run at, I think it was River Downs at the time. And we had her in, and I go into the in the paddock, and I tell the jock, I had my phone out, and I was playing a little techno music by her stall, and she said, do-do-do-do-do-do, and Dean Sarvis rode the horse, and he comes out, and he goes, what's the plan here, Johnny? I said, Dean, what's the fastest tune song that you know of? Just whatever it is, sing it to her in the warm-up, sing it to her coming out of the gate, and just win with her. Exactly what I told him. And he comes back, and the filly runs and wins, just gallops. I think she won by like 8 or something. And he comes back, he's like, Johnny, I think she liked my song. And we started laughing. I couldn't believe it. It was just so funny. That was the weirdest instructions I have ever given anybody.
What song did he sing?
I don't know. You didn't tell me, but
have you heard him sing? I've heard him sing at jockey karaoke. It's not pretty.
Maybe that's why she was running fast. Try to get away from that. No, it was hysterical. I mean, it's the weirdest thing. But hey, those are instructions from Kellen to me, and the instructions from his owner to him. So I relayed on the message, and it worked. So. And then from then on, believe me, I'm a believer. Whatever works for your horse, I'm going to do it.
Dean Sarvis got himself a mount for life.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Great story. John Ortiz with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, are you ever confused for the actor John Ortiz who starred in Luck?
You know what? No, I don't think so. Nobody's ever said anything like that to me before. I haven't had any phone calls yet asking me to start in the next movie, so I think we're okay.
You remember who his character was, don't you? Do you remember that? John Ortiz?
He played
Turo Escalante.
Yeah.
That was his character.
It was supposed to be a knockoff of Julio Canani.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Turo Escalante. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So, John, you mentioned that you got a chance when you were working with Bill Mott to travel with some of his top stakes horses. Look back on those days. What's your favorite story of traveling with one of the big-name horses in Bill's barn?
Oh, man. There's so many. I remember, I'll tell you what, I think my favorite one was when I went to the West Virginia Derby. No, not West Virginia. The Virginia Derby, right, in Colonial Downs?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I went there with two horses. I think I went there with, I think he had Court Vision at the time. And I remember I was going there, and I was just, I can't remember how old I was, but I remember a couple people came up to the barn with notepads and a camera, and he's like, oh, I was the only one there. And they're like, okay, John, listen, you know, you're here with the horse. They're like, you don't mind if we give you an interview? I was like, what? I was like, I don't know. So I called Bill. I was like, Bill, they want an interview. Do you want to talk to them? And he's like, no, go ahead, son, take care of it. I was like, what? And so they gave me that was like my first little interview. Came out in the little local newspaper or whatever. And that I liked it because it gave me a feeling. I was like, oh, I feel like a little trainer at this time. You know, I think I had to be maybe 17 or 18 years old. But I was like, man, I like that. I felt like I know what I'm doing. I know what I'm talking about. And just experiencing, just going out there and saddling or being a part, leading up a horse for Bill Mott, you know, in a grade one or a grade two or wherever I went across the country for him. It was a very proud moment. I always felt like, you know, I'm proud of just being a part of it, you know. And it got my head into where I said, I want to do this. I want to keep on doing this. I want it to be me one day.
Did you have a favorite horse when you worked for Bill?
Yes, I did. My favorite horse was Silver Tree.
Good horse.
Silver Tree. I think he won the Virginia Derby one year. I'm pretty positive. But I think that was right before me. But I used to gallop him, you know, when I was working. And he was a strong horse. I think he was older at the time there, but man, he was such a good looking horse. Just so muscular and just strong to gallop, man. And I just love getting on him every morning. And he was an angry horse. Like, he'll bite at you, you know, at the stall. And he got me a couple of times. I got a couple horse tattoos. you know what those are when they bite you across the screen there, and you grab your arm and they just leave that big bruise. And I remember I just love that horse so much.
How many times did you get bit when you were training, JT?
Oh, I got bit. I'd say probably half a dozen times. I got kicked once really badly with the first horse I ever won $100,000 with. I almost wasn't able to have kids, if you know what I mean. I had a bruise on my inner thigh that was on there for about 8 months. And a horse named Pewter Gray. I claimed him. I didn't have a stall for him. I put him in a pony stall, and this was like a 17-hands horse. And I got in there to rub him the next morning. I didn't know he was mean. And he kicked me, and I went flying. I mean, that takes a lot, you know. And he nailed me. My brother Bob ended up taking care of him because he was really mean, but he liked Bob for some reason. And Bob took care of him, and Bob had actually found him. He saw him race one day and found him, but he was a mean horse too.
Well, you hear about all the injuries that jockeys sustain, and rightfully so, because that's a very dangerous profession. But it sounds to me, and John, I'll let you speak to this, it sounds to me like being a trainer can sometimes be equally as dangerous.
Oh, yeah. Of course, you always want to be careful when you're in a barn period, and you're always worried about the people just walking by. But, you know, from, like you said, just a horse trying to savage you through the webbings or the gates. I mean, I've seen people get thrown inside a stall just for the horse to just reach out and just grab them by the arm. Then you always have horses turn around and kick you. I mean, I was kicked here about maybe in December by this one filly that I have in on Saturday. I really like her. She's so quiet and mellow in there, but I don't know, I went to go pick up her leg and just pick her feet out, and she nailed me right in my inner thigh too, and I was like, geez Louise. It's like, and then also, you know, it's wearing a metal ring is not a good idea to do in the barn. And I realized that real quick. I almost got I felt the nail cling onto the my ring, and then that just made me, whoa, I could lose a finger here. Mm. So I got a rubber wedding ring.
Smart move.
Yeah, just, you never know. You know, either you even get caught on the rain or something. It's just so.
Yeah, those are becoming quite popular. They're you see a lot of people that engage in sports wearing them. Pretty handy.
I never would have thought about that. That's why I wasn't a horse trainer. See, that's why. That was the reason.
Horse trainers always know that if something can go bad, it will. And you can never be too careful.
Yeah, whenever. It's not that simple, you know. It's just one thing after the other.
John, you mentioned galloping a horse like Silver Tree for Hall of Famer Bill Mott. You also mentioned earlier that you got the chance when you were working with Graham Motion to gallop $4 million earner Better Talk Now. Tell me about that experience.
Oh, I love that. I have pictures of that one. He was so cool. I think there was a jock supposed to come breed his horse, and I didn't think he'd make it out in time. And Graham just saw me standing there and said, "Johnny, why don't you get on this horse and breeze him?" I think I breezed him against this horse that he had at the time. His name was Rebellion. Rebellion or Rebellious? I think it was Rebellion. And it was like riding a Cadillac. I don't know. It was just the smoothest thing I have ever been on in my whole entire life. It's just because he wasn't a big horse. He was like really tall and kind of long and narrow, but he wasn't like you're sitting on a massive amount of horse here that, you know, it was just the smoothest thing. It's just so like riding, I don't know, like I said, a Cadillac or something. I got to work him over across the turf course at Palmetto's. And that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I can imagine when you get the keys to the Cadillac, it could be a little nerve-wracking too, was it?
Yeah, you know what? I never get nerves, you know, get all worried about getting on big or nice horses. I just think just because I grew up in Bill's barn, you know, I've got to see so many nice horses. It's kind of feel like that's what I learned to ride. I learned to ride these kind of horses, these grade ones, these allowance horses, and well-bred horses, Windstar horses. And I was like, so that made it very easy for me to learn how to balance myself so much just because those horses are so well-balanced, period. And so when I got on a horse, like, I was more happy and just like, oh, starstruck, you know? Yeah.
Well, a lot of people would give their right arm to have a shed row that looks like Bill Mott's or a guy like Todd Pletcher or Graham Motion. How about when John Ortiz walks down his shed row at Oaklawn? What types of horses are in your barn right now?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm actually looking down on the shed right now, and I couldn't be happier with the horses that I have under my care right now. And like I mentioned earlier, I only have 13 right now. I would like to get more. But I'm happy with what I have right now. I have a horse that broke his maiden the first stall here. He broke his maiden at Remington Park. That's my second winner for Mr. Tommy Julian and at his home track. So he gets the first stall because he's our first official winner. And then I just have a bunch of nice. I claim most of my horses. I claim them all for 30 and in that range, 30 to 20. And I picked up a couple that I had with Kellen Gorder. I have an All Right who broke his maiden in Kentucky Downs in the $350, juvenile, going up and down those hills. And I have a filly that I started. Actually, I won with her, broke a maiden, and won second time out here at Oaklawn last year. And when she came back, she had a break over the summer, and when I brought her back, she got to run under my name, and I ran her in the Mahoning Valley distaff, and she finished second. And I almost thought I was going to break my maiden in a stake race, so that was pretty cool. So these are the kind of horses I have, you know, two horses that I'm going to try to improve them. Just trying to get the money here, you know. I want to put them where they're going to win, and if not, we're going to get to just have fun with these horses. And that's the beauty of having owners like Tommy Julian and Bill Helwig and Grant Gassaway is that they want to have fun. You know, we're here to have fun and make money and just place them where they belong and, you know, try to get the money.
Yeah, that's always the key. When you don't have many horses, a lot of trainers want to keep the horses around and they run them over their heads. But if you can run them where they belong and turn them over and win some races, that's where the fun comes in. That means lots of dinner parties.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we'll have way more dinner parties when you're doing that, that's for sure.
John, do you have any race day superstitions or anything like that that you typically try to stick to when you're running horses?
Yeah, I do. There's a lot of, you know, typical horsemen. You know, superstitious, you know. I don't know why, but every time I run a horse, I'm in the paddock, after I leave the horse up, I always tell the jock, you know, good luck, ride safe. That's very important to me. I just want to make sure the jock has a nice, safe trip. So I always say that. And then as soon as I hand off the horse and I go back up to the grandstand, I find a wall and I kick my heels against the wall. I get to get the dirt off my shoes, but I don't know. I've always done it, and I picked up on it, I think, 2 years ago that I was doing it here at the paddock in Oakland. I was just like, I'm always kicking this wall. I don't know why, but I'm going to keep doing it. So every time I bring the horse up, and that's what I do. And, of course, you know, you always got your lucky spots, so you're going to have to go watch the race from the same exact spot every single time. But, yeah, those are just probably my two superstitions. And always having a clean barn. I think that's very, very important to me. And I think that's probably because of my mom. She always told me that, you know, if you have a dirty room, it's bad luck. And if you have, you know, you should. I think that was just her method of, you know, making me clean my room. But it works because now my barn is always spotless. So,
have you ever kicked the wall after the race, John?
No, not really. Probably not. Something matters. Something. Take a little bit. I'm like, dang it.
John Ortiz with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you're not familiar with that name, well, we told you at the top of the show that John started training on his own last year, but he had a solid foundation working for Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott. That's where he started his career, went to Graham Motion, worked with Barkley Tag, and then with Kellen Gorder as well. John, Kellen is getting ready to come back after serving a 14-month suspension. Have you had any conversations with him in recent months about, you know, how you might be able to kind of work together, or is that even an option when he comes back to training?
I've been able to stay in contact with him just because he's my he's a family, you know, family friend. You know, he met my son when he was born, came out to the hospital, and it was only a 2-month suspension. But you know, yeah, I think he's getting ready to come back, and I've always told him that if he needs any sort of help, you know, he's actually going to stable on the backside of my barn. So we're going to share a barn. He knows that if he needs any help, and same way, if I need any help, he's always said that we'll work together. You know, it's always been that way with Kellen. You know, like I said, he's been that guy that, you know how laid back he is, and he's just such a good fella that you need something, he won't hesitate to say no. And he'll correct you when you need to be corrected, you know, and guide you in the right path. And I think a lot of that has come down from Kellen. You know, that's why I'm in the situation I'm in right now, where, you know, I'm able to, he trusted me to run his bond, and he knows that I'm capable of running my own shit, you know, correctly.
Well, I like the way you said that he'll correct you when you need to be corrected, and you learned well, because you just did that to me as well. Originally a 1-year suspension or 14 months reduced down to 2 months. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was 60 days.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
That's when I went off on my own.
I knew I had the 14 months in my head somewhere.
Well, that was the original. Yeah. That was the whole deal with that. And it's kind of crazy, but that's another story.
Well, it'll be good to see him back on the racetrack. And glad to know that you've been able to stay in touch and be part of the family too, because that's so important going forward.
Yeah, no, it is. Like I said, family first, all of it. You know, close friends like Kellen and, you know, Channing Hill. He's one of my closest friends. And then Josh Flores out in, he's an assistant to D'Amato out in California right now. We try to stay in touch with each other. And, you know, you realize there's just a lot more things that are more important than just, you know, gossiping or making money or just, you know, just having a good crew by your side. It's really what it takes to be a better person, I think.
Yeah, it's nice to have those friends, and you can bounce things off one another. I liked what you said earlier about you don't put anything above you, and that's important, because it's a business where you can learn from everybody, and sometimes somebody has a better idea and it behooves you to use it.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's just so much you can do as far as learning. You learn so much just by watching. You know, you could just be involved. That's one thing I've always done. I think I've watched Steve Asmussen very closely, and you know, I've learned so much off of just the way he runs his outfit. And I think I worked for Steve when I was 18 years old, jogging horses. He doesn't even remember, you know. But just watching good horsemen, being around good people, just, you know, you pick up a lot of good things.
So, John, tell me about the plan moving forward. What goals does John Ortiz want to accomplish, not just this winter at Oaklawn, but over the long term?
Over the long term, well, obviously, you know, probably, and I'll do it like this, it's just you always have to aim high just so you know that you have a goal. And like I said, when I was 21, I said I wanted to be a trainer, and I did it just because I had the opportunity to, and then it grew into what I have now. My main goal is obviously I want to be either recognized as a Hall of Fame trainer. You know, I want to have grade one horses, and I want to be a grade one winner. I don't necessarily think that I need to have over 100 or 200 horses to do that. I would love to do it just with a small barn between 20, 50 horses. You know, I'd be happy with something like that. Like I said, right now I train for Tommy Julian, and you know, something that we have is just a small outfit that we want to just bang out winners and just make money, and something like this, you know, we'll get there. You know, just we'll find the right horse that we can improve or just fix, and you know, take me there eventually. You know, that takes years to become a Hall of Fame trainer. So in between there, you know, I want to win the title. I want to win the title for my owner, you know, whether it's being Kentucky or in another state or here in Oakland. That's going to be tough because, you know, you always got Danny Caldwell here. It's always leading owner. It's a great friend of mine, actually. He's the one that put everything together to help me get started. He's had so much faith in me. And just like that, for people like that, you know, I want to always do well for. So.
Well, John, you're always looking out for everybody else, and it sounds like a great business plan, and it's working very well for you to this point. So keep it rolling, my friend. Thank you for being with us on Trainer Talk tonight. Really enjoyed hearing your story, and all the best moving forward.
All right, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for letting me share my story and being a part of the show.
Go win some races.
We'll try. We have 4 in on Saturday, so let's get lucky.
All right, we'll be watching John Ortiz with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. And, boy, great. You know, it never gets old because everybody has something different to offer and bring to the table. And even though his story started, Jude, like a lot of other trainers we've had on this show, where they wanted to be a jockey, got too big, fell in love with the sport, and became a trainer, we hear that story a lot. There were so many different intricacies to John's story. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is a real interesting guy. And I love it's the second week in a row we've had somebody mention what an event it is when Graham Motion walks in the barn. I'm going to have to get up early at Saratoga and go stand there and see what that's like.
What does that mean? Is it a bit of a parade? Confetti?
Very regal. Very
pop the champagne?
Very British.
Yeah. Crack open the beer, throw it in the horse's feed, and we're ready to go. All right. For John Ortiz, we really appreciate him taking the time with us here on Trainer Talk tonight. Don't forget, next week, an all-new Trainer Talk comes your way Wednesday night. If you missed any portion of this show, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast at your leisure. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pennon. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.